The reading is taken from 1 Peter 3, verse 1 to 7. It's on page 1219 of the Church Bibles. Wives, in the same way, be submissive to your husbands, so that if any of them do not believe the word, they may be won over without words by the behavior of their wives. When they see the purity and reverence of your lives, your beauty should not come from outward adornment, such as braided hair and the wearing of gold jewelry and fine clothes. Instead, it should be that of your inner self, the unfading beauty of a gentle and quiet spirit, which is of great worth in God's sight. For this is the way the holy women of the past, who put their hope in God, used to make themselves beautiful. They were submissive to their own husbands, like Sarah, who obeyed Abraham and called him her master. You are her daughters if you do what is right and do not give way to fear. Husbands, in the same way, be considerate as you live with your wives and treat them with respect as the weaker partner and heirs with you of the gracious gift of life, so that nothing will hinder your prayers.
Well, good morning, everybody. It's great to have you with us this morning. I may need to do a quick adjustment. That's all right. There we go. It'd be helpful if you could keep that Bible passage open. And let's just pray, shall we, for God's help as we turn to his word. Heavenly Father, we want to thank you and praise you that the Bible is not a dead word, it's not a past word, but it is your living word to us today. Thank you that by your Spirit you say to us the same things today that you said through your apostles and through your prophets in the past. We ask and pray that you might help us to hear, to understand, and to obey what you have to say to us. In Jesus' name, amen. Well, how are we to go about winning people for Christ? That's one of our most important tasks as Christians and as a church. How are we to go about winning people for Christ? Is it by our words or is it by our lives? Is it by evangelism, or is it by example, a kind of osmosis? St. Francis of Assisi very famously said, preach the gospel always, use words if necessary, that somehow it's your life that is to communicate the gospel. You don't need to say anything. Is he right? Well, that's the question that Peter addresses here in chapter 3, verses 1 to 7. I know that the specific issue is how Christian wives should relate to their unbelieving husbands. But I think the more general issue that's being raised here is how do we win people for Christ? It was for the wives who were in this situation, it was a very difficult situation. In the ancient world, wives were expected to obey their husbands. And in particular, wives were expected to follow the religion and worship the gods of their husbands. Plutarch, who was a Roman writer writing at pretty much the same time, wrote this. He said, a wife should not acquire her own friends, but should make her husband's friends her own. The gods are the first and most significant friends. For this reason, it's proper for a wife to recognize only those gods whom her husband worships and to shut the door to superstitious cults and superstitions. As a wife, you are expected to worship the gods of your husband. So for a wife to choose to become a Christian was actually an act of rebellion. It would mean that she wasn't worshipping her husband's gods. It would mean that she was associating with all the wrong people. She'd have all of these new friends in the Christian community, maybe slaves and other people the husband wouldn't want anything to do with. Maybe her involvement in this new Christian community would affect her husband's social standing. 1 Corinthians 7 suggests that she was even in danger of being divorced because of her new faith and not following the gods of her husband. So she's in a very difficult situation. And Peter addresses the question, how is she to go about winning her unbelieving husband? And in chapter 3 and verse 1, what Peter does is he commands wives to win their husbands for Christ, or to seek to win their husbands for Christ by the way that they live. This follows on from what we've been seeing in 1 Peter over previous weeks. We've been seeing that 1 Peter is all about how Christians are to live and impact the world in which they find themselves. We've seen that Christians are God's people living in hostile territory. We're strangers and aliens. We've seen that we're, as God's people, called to mediate God's blessings to the world. We are priests who are to mediate between God and others. And that the way that we're to do that is by living holy lives. We saw the key verse in this section of 1 Peter is chapter 2, verses 11 and 12. Live such good lives amongst the pagans, with the objective that the pagans will ultimately come to glorify God when he visits us. And we've been seeing over the past few weeks that Christians are to live out these good holy lives in the context of their social relationships. So citizens are to submit to the authorities and do good in society. Slaves are to obey their masters and do good and bear unjust suffering. And then in this final section, wives similarly are to do good by submitting to their husbands. It's not perhaps evident in the passage, but in chapter 3 and verse 6, when it says to the wives here that they're to do what is right, what it literally says is you're to do good. It's exactly the same word. It's the same theme carrying on. Wives are to do good in their relationship with their husbands. You see, doing good is a way of winning people to Christ. And I think as we think back over this whole section, we need to recognize that it's not just about avoiding persecution for the sake of the gospel, but it's actually about evangelism. It's actually about winning people for Christ by the way that we live. In verses 1 to 7, as we can see, Peter focuses on the relationship between wives and husbands. But I want to suggest, rather as I did last time, that actually it has a wider application than that. Last time I was speaking about how slaves are in many ways a paradigm for Christians who are experiencing unjust suffering. I want to suggest that in this passage, the wives are a paradigm for how we win others to Christ. That was the specific situation that Peter was dealing with, but the principles he sets out have a much wider application than simply to that one situation. The behavior that's commanded of the wives here, as we'll see when we look at the passage in detail, is not in fact unique to wives. The behavior that's asked of wives here is actually behavior that is asked of all Christians, not simply wives. Just in the same way that the behavior that was asked of slaves is asked of all Christians. So if you're coming expecting a sermon that's just going to be about husbands and wives and marriage, if you're thinking, I'm not in that situation or I know everything about that, I'm going to be able to turn off, that's not going to be the case. What I want to do is draw out four lessons from chapter 3, verses 1 to 7. And I want to, first of all, draw out two general lessons for all Christians. And then I want to draw out two specific lessons for husbands and wives. You might think that's a slightly odd order, but I wanted to put the ones that are general for all of us first so that we're all engaged by them and that those of you who are not husbands and wives are not turned off by the time we finally get to what speaks directly to you. So four lessons. Firstly, two general lessons. And the first is this. I think what we can learn from this passage is that Christians must live good lives to try to win those who've rejected the gospel. Christians must live good lives to try to win those who have rejected the gospel. Chapter 3, verse 1, Peter is writing to the wives of unbelieving husbands, and he's urging them to win over their husbands by their lives. And I think if we're to understand this passage correctly, the crucial thing to grasp is that these husbands have already heard the gospel and rejected it. It's not that these are people who haven't heard the gospel. They have heard the gospel and they have rejected it. The phrase that says, if any of them do not believe the word, is more literally, if any are disobedient to the word. It implies that they've already heard it. I mean, after all, their wife has become a Christian. Their wife has started going to church. She started attending this new group. She's got new friends. The likelihood is that the wife has already explained the gospel to the husband. But the husband has rejected it. He has become disobedient to the word he has heard. The word here is clearly the gospel. So what we're talking about here are husbands of Christian wives who have heard the gospel but have rejected it. I think this reminds us that there are really two great dangers in evangelism, two great failures that we can fall into. The first is the failure of not saying anything at all, not sharing and explaining the gospel to those who haven't heard it, who haven't been confronted with the claims of Christ. That's one danger of being silent. The other danger is actually the danger of saying too much. It's the danger of keeping on nagging about the gospel when that is counterproductive to somebody who has already heard it and has rejected it. Peter isn't here saying that people are won for Christ simply by the example of their lives, as if Christianity is caught like a disease or passed by osmosis. Peter is not here supporting the kind of St. Francis of Assisi view. But he's saying that where people have heard and where they've rejected the gospel, there is simply no point in trying to nag them further into belief. He says instead their lives are to do the talking. So Peter's primary point here is a warning to Christian wives of unbelieving husbands who are no doubt desperate for their husbands to come to Christ. And maybe they think they should be taking every opportunity to confront their husband about the gospel. Maybe they should be sharing it with them when they wake up in the morning, over breakfast, over lunch, every time that they come back from church. Maybe they should keep inviting them to church services and meetings. In effect, to be constantly nagging them about the gospel and their unbelief. And Peter says that's counterproductive. That is just going to be a turn-off. They've heard the gospel. What they need to see is that your life is radically transformed by the gospel. That the gospel has made a difference and has made you a better wife. And I think that that principle applies not just to wives who are married to unbelievers. Surely it applies in a whole much wider variety of situations. It, of course, applies similarly to a husband who has an unbelieving wife. It might apply to parents who have unbelieving children. How often parents with unbelieving children constantly nag them to become Christians? And it becomes counterproductive. Maybe it applies to Christian children who've got unbelieving parents. Maybe you've become a Christian sometime as a young person or as a student. You'd love your family to be converted. You've told them the gospel, and there's a danger of you simply going on and nagging them about the gospel. There's a point at which that can become counterproductive. Similarly, for example, with your work colleagues, maybe you've kind of already told them the gospel, and it becomes counterproductive to go in and tell them it again every Monday morning when you arrive in at work. Maybe it becomes counterproductive to invite them to Jazz in the Gardens for yet another year. So I think the principle here has a much wider application than simply wives and husbands. There's a time when people have rejected the gospel that they've heard, where it's not helpful to keep on speaking. So maybe if you come from a non-Christian family and you're going home for Christmas, you've told them the gospel in the past, they've understood it, they grasp it. Maybe this is not the time to go home and give them a fresh start again at the beginning of the Christmas holidays. Badger them again about the gospel. Maybe if you've told your colleagues at work in the office about Christ and they've rejected him, maybe the best thing is not to go in on Monday morning and seek to speak to them about the gospel again. But remember, this is about people who have heard and have disobeyed. It's saying for them, you need to back up what they already know by the quality of your life. And so what Peter is saying here doesn't at all take away from the urgent need to tell the gospel to those who haven't heard it, to those who haven't had opportunity to disobey it and to reject it. When I look back over the 16 years I spent working in the university and in academic life, I don't regret the way that I lived amongst my colleagues. I think I do regret not sharing the gospel with people more. I think I regret not taking more opportunities to be able to speak to those who had not heard and disobeyed the gospel more directly about Jesus Christ, who he is and what he's done. I think it's very easy to have left work with the reputation of having been a nice chap, but not actually of having had a great deal of impact because of not having spoken, not having explained. We must never use what Peter says here in chapter 3, verses 1 to 6 as an excuse for not speaking of Christ to those who haven't heard and rejected the gospel. That's not Peter's point at all. But where people have heard and have rejected and have disobeyed, then what Peter is saying is it's the evidence of a life lived for God that will win people over. To the wives, he says in verse 2, what's going to make the difference, what's going to win them, is when they see the purity and reverence of your lives. A purity there was actually a virtue that was valued in the ancient world. It's a word that largely means kind of sexual purity. And in the ancient world, Roman and Greek men wanted their wives to be modest and pure, not to be like the prostitutes, not to be like the others. Peter's saying the effect of your Christian faith is that you should be pure in a way that is evident to your husbands. And he says that you're to see the reverence of your lives. The word reverence there is a word that we've come across a number of times in this section of kind of 1 Peter. It's a word that means fear. It's a word that means the right attitude towards God. Your husband is to see that your purity flows out of your fear of God and your desire to serve him and live for him. That it's your faith that leads to transformed behavior. Your faith leads you to be a better wife. Maybe again we can translate that into a whole variety of contexts. It's our faith that should make us better children and better parents. It's our faith that should make us better work colleagues. It's our faith that should make us better friends as we seek to relate to those who have heard but have disobeyed the gospel. So I think that's the first general lesson that we can learn from this passage, that Christians must live good lives to win those who have rejected the gospel. And I guess that leaves an obvious challenge. Is that how you're living? As you live amongst those whom you've shared the gospel with but who have rejected it, is your life demonstrating the power and the reality of the gospel in the way that you live? You need to make sure that it's your life that is speaking. Well, secondly, the second general lesson, I think, is that Christians must value and cultivate inner character rather than external beauty. Christians must value and cultivate inner character rather than external beauty. We live in a culture, don't we, that's absolutely obsessed with appearance. We live in a society in which basically the only people who are powerful are the people who are beautiful. If you are beautiful, you are listened to, you are noticed, you are honoured. If you're unattractive, you're not. We see it in the whole way that kind of older newscasters are ditched from their jobs in favour of kind of attractive 30-year-olds. We don't want to see middle-aged people on television. We want to see young, beautiful, fresh-faced people. People spend immense amounts of time and money trying to be beautiful and trying to stay beautiful. You look at the messages that are constantly communicated on the television. Endless makeover programmes that are telling you how to make the best of yourself in terms of external appearance. You look at the adverts that are constantly playing on your insecurities. You're not really beautiful. If you're not beautiful, you don't matter. Buy our incredibly expensive product and you'll be somebody who people will value and take notice of. Read any Saturday or Sunday newspaper and in virtually all of the sort of sections in it, it'll be about how you can be more beautiful, how you can attain power in that way. And of course, in our culture, it's not just women who are prey to that, but men as well. I think women are especially prey to it. I think the vast majority of women are utterly insecure about the way that they look and are under constant pressure because of it. But I think men are as well. For men, it might take the form of kind of how much time they spend in the gym to get the kind of six-pack that everybody seems to think is required. There's a massive market in male clothing, perfumes, cosmetics, sort of care products. This is not just a female issue in our culture. It's a male issue as well. And what Peter says here in this passage, I think, therefore, really challenges us in our culture. Because what Peter says is that Christians are to be concerned about inner beauty, about character above appearance. Peter says that these Christian wives are to win their husbands by the beauty of their character. Their priority is not to be outward decoration. It's not to be fancy hairstyles, expensive jewellery, fine clothing. Instead, Peter says what's to be attractive about them is the lasting inner beauty of a gentle and quiet spirit. Now, I don't think at all Peter is saying that therefore there is no place for making yourself attractive externally. He's not saying that that is completely ruled out. Actually, literally, he says here, don't wear clothes at all. If we took what Peter says literally, basically he'd be saying that we should all be naked all of the time. So it's clearly not what he means. What he's talking about here is a kind of an excessive indulgence of kind of external beauty. So he's not saying never bother with your hair when you get up in the morning. He's saying that shouldn't be the priority. The priority is inner character because it lasts. And you see, the interesting thing is that actually these kind of virtues were also valued in Roman and Greek society. Paul wasn't actually being particularly countercultural here in terms of how he was asking women to be modest and virtuous. Turning back to Plutarch again, he said this. He said, it's not gold or precious stones or scarlet that makes a wife beautiful, but whatever invests her with that something that betokens dignity, good behaviour and modesty. Actually, this is what Roman husbands wanted. They wanted their wives to be modest in their appearance. But again, I want to suggest that what's being said here isn't just about wives and women. Actually, what Peter says is, I think, applicable to all Christians. Peter says that the beauty that we're to look for is the beauty of your inner self. Now, what Peter literally says there is that what we're to be concerned about is the beauty of what he calls the secret place of the heart. It's what your inner self literally says. It's the secret place of the heart. And actually, what Peter is doing here is he's looking back to 1 Samuel chapter 6 and verse 17. I think it's 1 Samuel 16, verse 7. I can't remember. But whatever it is, it's where God looks and chooses David to be king. And it says God doesn't look to the external appearance, but actually to the heart. See, this isn't just about women. Peter isn't just saying, women, you should be concerned about your inner character. Actually, this is generic for Christians. God is concerned about the secret place of the heart, not the external appearance. And interestingly, his phrase that they're to have a quiet and gentle spirit, that little phrase is, again, not uniquely feminine. It's easy to read this and think that a quiet and gentle spirit is therefore a feminine characteristic. This is just what women should be like. But actually, both of those virtues are spoken of as being for all Christians. So to be gentle, the word is literally the word that is translated meek. Jesus himself is described as being meek. And later on in 1 Peter 3, verse 16, Peter says that all Christians are to behave in this way. This is not uniquely for women. Actually, meekness, gentleness, is a generic Christian virtue. Similarly, having a quiet spirit is picked up in the New Testament as being something that all Christians are to have. What it really means is that you're not to have an argumentative or a disputing spirit. And you can find in 1 Timothy chapter 2 and 1 Thessalonians 4 and 2 Thessalonians 3 that all Christians are urged to be quiet in this way. So although in the particular context, Peter is urging these virtues on these kind of wives of unbelieving husbands, it's not that these are uniquely female virtues. They're actually generic Christian virtues. All Christians should be meek as Jesus was meek. All Christians should be quiet in the sense of not being argumentative and not stirring disagreement and argument. So though Peter is particularly calling wives to behave in this way, I think we can say that this applies more generally to all Christians, that we should be concerned not with our external appearance but with our inner character, whether we are meek, whether we are peaceable rather than argumentative. So I think the question for all of us is this: are you developing Christian character as a priority? Are you developing Christian character as a priority? I wonder how much time a day you spend on your appearance. compared to how much you spend a day on developing those Christian characteristics? What is most important to you? Is it the way you look? Or is it who you are? What Peter is saying here is that as Christians, we should be concerned about that beauty that lasts, the beauty of our inner characters. We need to work, all of us, on meekness. We need to work, all of us, on quietness. Those are Christian virtues. And I want to say, do you value those Christian characteristics in others? Do you kind of, in a sense, evaluate other people by their character or by their look? It's very easy, isn't it, for us to actually value other people by what they look like. So we give more attention and more time to the people who are beautiful, who appear to be valuable. We're taken in simply by their appearance, and we give no thought to their character. Do we value character over appearance? Or in the way that we actually live, do we show day by day that appearance is actually far more important to us? Well, the warning for us here is if we think appearance is more important, we'll be disappointed, because that's not what God thinks is important. What God thinks is important is inner character. Maybe you're somebody who's single and you're looking for a husband or a wife. What are you looking for? Is it character? Or is it appearance? Do you want just a trophy wife or a trophy husband who everybody else is going to look at and think, gosh, didn't they do well to get somebody who looks like that? Or are you thinking, no, I want a godly husband or a godly wife? Christians must value and cultivate inner character rather than external beauty. So two lessons for us all generally. Thirdly, moving more specifically to husbands and wives, Christian wives must submit to their husbands. Peter's specific instruction, following on from the instruction to citizens and to slaves in verse 1, is, wives, be submissive to your husbands. I think what that clearly means is that wives are to be willingly accepting the authority of their husbands over them. And it's implicit here that that willingness to submit is not dependent on the quality of the husband. It's not because he's a particularly good husband. I mean, after all, Peter is addressing this instruction to women who are married to unbelievers. He says, irrespective of who your husband is, you are called by God to submit. And that submission clearly involves obedience. Do you notice that in 3 verse 6, when Peter speaks about the example of Sarah, he says, Sarah, who obeyed Abraham. He just uses sort of submission and obedience as kind of synonymous. I think I'd want to suggest that actually submission is more than obedience, not less than obedience. Submission is a kind of a willing acceptance of the authority that is over you, not just a reluctant doing of what you're told to do. So in a way, submission is actually more comprehensive in that it encompasses the attitude to the authority, not just the doing of what you're commanded to do. Notice very importantly here that this is not a command about the relationships between men and women in general. Peter doesn't say to women, women, submit to men. He's not saying that every woman is under the authority of any man. This is exclusively about the relationship of husband and wife. What it literally says in the Greek is, wives, submit to your own husbands, and implicitly not to any other man but him. And I want to suggest that this command here to submit is, it cannot be dismissed as simply cultural or simply pragmatic. There's no doubt that Greek and Roman society expected wives to submit to husbands. But when we read the Bible, we discover that that isn't simply a cultural demand. We find that it's rooted in creation. And if you want to find out more about that, come tonight, because Neil's going to be preaching on precisely that subject. It's rooted in the relationship between Christ and the church, as we can see from Ephesians chapter 5. The call to submit is not purely cultural. And nor is it just pragmatic. Some people might say, well, okay, what Peter is doing here is he's telling these wives, submit to your husbands simply for the sake of winning them for Christ. It's kind of what they expect. Give them what they want, and then maybe they'll become believers. Not at all. in verse 1, do you notice Peter commands the wives to submit to their husbands, irrespective of whether their husbands are believers or not? He says, submit to your husbands if some of them do not believe. The implication is that quite a lot of their husbands do believe. And of course, the example of Sarah in verse 6 is of a wife submitting to her believing husband, Abraham. So this is not, again, specific about the relationship between Christian wives and unbelieving husbands. What Peter is doing is saying that a Christian wife should behave in a way in relation to her unbelieving husband in a way a Christian wife should behave to her believing husband. And I think that what's being called for here on the part of wives is a constant attitude of submission, a constant recognition of the authority of her husband. I think we pick that up particularly from the way that Peter draws on the example of Sarah. Do you notice in verse 6 it says, like Sarah, who obeyed Abraham and called him her master. She recognized his authority. Now what's really interesting is that little incident of Sarah calling Abraham her master is taken from Genesis chapter 18 verse 12. It's the only place in the Bible in which Sarah calls Abraham her master. So it must be the reference Peter has in mind. But the really interesting thing is in that reference, Sarah is not speaking to Abraham. She's actually speaking to herself. And that's really important because it shows that this is just her whole way of thinking. Whenever she thinks about Abraham and discusses him, she is recognizing that he has authority over her. You see, this kind of submission and attitude of submission is not just to be when the husband is watching, but actually all the time. So imagine sort of a bunch of wives go out for dinner together. It's a girls' night out, and they start talking about their husbands. How easy it is in that context to talk about their husbands in a totally different way from the way they talk to their husbands directly. At home, they might appear to be submissive and accepting their husband's authority. When they're out there at the pub together, husband is a tyrant who needs to be overthrown. Man who's there to be mocked for all his failings and his foibles. Now you see, the point is that Sarah perceived Abraham in this way all the time, even when she was speaking just to herself. It was her disposition, it was her attitude towards her husband. So Christian wives, you're called to willingly submit to your husband in everything. Do you notice this is not a submission that can be forced? This is not something in a way that you can be made to do. This relationship is not like slavery, where if the master finds the slave disobeys, he can beat them or whatever. But what Peter is calling for is a willing submission to your husband. And I think here, a willing submission in everything. In every area of life. It might be a willing submission in that where you live, whether you work, how much work you do, in relation to family life, the way that children are brought up, the number of children that you might have, in relation to holidays, where you go, when you go, in relation to where you go and spend Christmas, whose family it might be with, in relation to the time that you spend with friends, the friends that you have, in relation to your sex life and your relationship. It covers all aspects of your relationship. And Peter is calling for that willing submission. Of course, the demand to submit is not absolute. As in all of these relationships, loyalty to Christ must come first. After all, in a way, the wife of the unbelieving husband has disobeyed him in that most fundamental area. Peter is wanting to say, given that you've disobeyed him in that most fundamental area, show him in every other area what a good submissive wife you are by the way that you live. So maybe you're a woman and you're single. Maybe you're looking for a husband. What kind of man do you want to marry? Are you looking for a man who you'd be willing to submit to in this comprehensive way? Do you understand what marriage will actually involve? It's so easy to go into marriage thinking, there's the husband, I like them for all of these reasons, and in the areas that I don't like him, I'll be able to change him. That's exactly the opposite of submission. Are you looking for a husband who you can trust to love you, to act in your best interests, to exercise that authority in a godly and loving way? And when you think about what marriage involves, how could you contemplate marrying an unbeliever? These women found themselves in this incredibly difficult situation because they were converted after they'd been married. But how could you willingly put yourself in that situation of having to kind of bear with a husband who doesn't share the thing which is most central to you? And if you're a man and you're looking for a wife, are you looking for godly character and submissiveness? Is that what you most want in a wife? Somebody who demonstrates that willingness to accept authority. It's all too easy to be taken in simply by appearance and think that that is the most important thing. But actually, in the day-to-day reality of marriage, it is submission that is the most important thing. So Christian wives must submit to their husbands. I'm very conscious that there are 1,001 things I'd love to say about marriage that I can't say in this one sermon. If you'd like to know a little bit more about how the dynamics of marriage work out, we preached a series on it a year or so ago. And there's a kind of a whole series of 9 sermons on CD that you can buy and that you can listen to, where some of the practicalities of submission and what it means are worked out. So my apologies that I can't qualify everything this morning. But can I urge you, if you would like to know more, to buy the CDs, listen to them, and that will perhaps help you. Lastly, Christian husbands must honour their wives as their equals. Christian husbands must honour their wives as their equals. Chapter 3 and verse 7, for the first time in this whole section of 1 Peter, Peter speaks to the stronger party in these social relationships. So he's addressed citizens in relation to the state, but he said nothing to the emperor. He's addressed slaves in relation to masters, but said nothing to masters. All of a sudden, having addressed wives, he speaks to husbands. And here he is clearly speaking to Christian husbands. And I think the reason why Peter steps in here and speaks to husbands is he absolutely wants to make sure that Christian husbands do not misunderstand what submission means on the part of their wives. Peter wants to make absolutely sure that Christian husbands understand that the submission of their wives in no way gives them any excuse for mistreating their wives. Nor does it in any way mean that their wives are inferior to them. In fact, exactly the opposite. The common Greek and Roman, and indeed Jewish, view of women was that women were inferior to men in every way. They were inferior intellectually, morally, spiritually, and physically. Standard Jewish prayer of a man every day was, "Thank God I have not been made a woman." Women were regarded as inferior and second class, and treated in that way, kind of institutionally. But Peter says here that Christian husbands are to understand that their wives are their equals. And actually, this is stunningly subversive for the society to which Peter was writing. Actually, it's what Peter has to say to wives here, sort of to husbands here, that in many ways is the more challenging word. See, Peter recognizes that women are more vulnerable. He says that they're weaker vessels. And I think there he probably means primarily their physical weakness. The vessel is a way of speaking of the body. Peter is clear that men are vessels. It's not that women are vessels and men aren't. They're both vessels, it's just that women are weaker vessels. And that's been demonstrated time and time again through history, isn't it? Women are the ones who are raped, abused, killed in all war situations. Almost invariably in domestic violence, it's the wife who's being beaten up. Most men can force their will on women by physical force if they have to. It's just a reality. But Peter says that women, even though they are physically weaker, are co-heirs with you of God's kingdom. He says that they are heirs with you of the gracious gift of life. Peter says to Christian husbands, your wife is going to share the inheritance of the kingdom with you equally. God's future belongs just as much to them as it does for you. There is no sense in which your wife is somehow not your equal. And the implication of that that's worked out is therefore you are to treat them with respect. What it literally says is you are to honour them. Husbands are to honour their wives. In other words, to give them that status of being equal co-heirs of the kingdom to come. To give them the status that they deserve before God, that society is not giving them. So Peter says, because your wife is your equal, therefore you must honour her and treat her with respect. He says, be considerate as you live with your wives. Actually, meaning of that is not exactly clear. It literally means live with your wives according to knowledge. Some commentators take it to mean knowing your wife and understanding her, hence the idea of being considerate. I think it's more likely that it means according to your knowledge of God. That it's the equivalent of the reverent fear that motivates the wife or the consciousness of God that motivates the slave. Peter is saying, because of your very relationship with God, therefore honour your wife as a co-heir with you of the kingdom to come. And interestingly, this command here may not be confined to husbands. In verse 7, where it says, your wives, husbands in the same way, be considerate as you live with your wives, the word is actually live with the women. It's actually not the same word as is used for wife in chapter 3 and verse 1. And it may well be that Peter is addressing Christian men about their relationships with all the women in their household. Not just their wife, but at least including their wife. And it's saying, as a Christian man, you are to treat all women with honour because they are your spiritual equal. And he backs it up by saying, if you mistreat your wife, or maybe if you mistreat women in general, God simply will not bless you. That's the point of this meaning, that sort of God will not answer your prayers. They will be hindered. The ancient world, the head of a household was meant to be praying for the peace and prosperity of the home, to be leading the family spiritually. And what Peter says is if you are mistreating your wife, if you're mistreating the women in your home, God will not listen. Your prayers will be hindered. Literally, it means your prayers will be cut off. There will be no answer. So if you're a Christian man, especially if you're a Christian husband, do you honour your wife? Do you honour women in general as equals? We all know that today we're all supposed to be politically correct. But that can just be a facade, can't it? We know not to say the wrong things to the wrong people. But deep down, our heart attitude can very easily be one of dismissing, knocking, mocking, effectively assuming that women and our wives are inferior. And Peter says there's to be no place for that within the Christian family. We are to honour our wives, honour women as our spiritual equals. So here's a pattern for Christian marriage. And to understand it, you have to put the two together. Wives willingly submitting to their husbands, husbands constantly honouring their wives as their equals. I think when we put those two things together, that's a very beautiful picture of how a relationship works. Sadly, many of the problems in marriages occur because that sort of, as it were, virtuous circle is turned into a vicious circle. As either the wife is not submitting, or the husband is not honouring, or neither are doing what they're supposed to be doing. If you're a husband or a wife and your marriage is struggling, think about which part of that virtuous circle has broken down. Put right your own behaviour before you assume that it's the other person. So there we have challenges from 1 Peter 3. We better stop there. But let's remember to lead good lives so that we win others for Christ who've rejected the gospel. Let's remember as husbands and wives to honour and submit in the way that Christ would call us. Thank you.